Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
We're talking under these ridiculous circumstances where the current economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C. that's brought on by those who created the deficit, and yet they expect all of us, except for the wealthiest Americans, to pay down all the costs, which will end up killing economic recovery. So how do we get into this mess?
Where does one start, you know? I mean, I think the best way to start, actually, one mentions the Bush tax cuts, which did vastly increase the deficit. But in truth, the giant deficits come from the Great Recession and the bank bailouts. I mean, the bank bailouts directly are expensive, but in truth, it's the giant fall off in national income that has so swelled deficits here. We've been over this terrain many times, Ian, and the truth is they should be running deficits now because the unemployment rate is so high. Trying to close these things as the Republicans are trying to do, like with big cuts next year, is quite insane and certainly is going to put, if they actually do this, which I think they will not, you know, it's going to put a lot more people out of work. Then, of course, the next stage in getting there is surely Obama's decisions to sort of essentially reverse his positions on the tax cuts. That is to say, he'd opposed extending them for the wealthy. Then he decided to do that. I mean, he said he wasn't going to do that past 2012, but they're already talking about some extension of that. And it created a lot of doubt in a lot of people's mind, myself included, as to whether, in fact, he wouldn't, in fact, cave again and just never go after them. I mean, that type of stuff added to sort of some anxieties about the deficit. This is not, as I say, something we should really be worrying about. But we got here, and then we get, finally, essentially the Republicans concentrating on two things, not just one thing. Yes, they want to cut the deficit. The other thing they're trying to do in most of these plans is generally give yet more tax cuts to the wealthy. I mean, that's built in even to the famous Ryan budget that is supposed to eventually cut, what's it, $4 trillion in spending over. They forget to mention it gives, you know, almost that sum actually in tax cuts out, too, mostly to upper income groups. So you have the Republicans pushing for, in effect, more tax cuts for the rich and still giant cuts in spending. And then you have basically a very weak response by the Obama administration. Now, in figuring out how we got there, the next step is probably the Obama administration's response, which, you know, they did one thing at the start that has been disastrous and has colored every aspect of American politics, which is they asked for a stimulus which was about half as big as it should have been, given the depth of the recession. And that has effectively discredited the idea. The failure of that to revive the economy, even though for sure it kept a lot of people employed. I mean, the number, for instance, of folks who would have lost jobs, you can just see that real easily. You just look at, say, the sort of the way state and local numbers are now dropping now that that stimulus is going off, state and local employment I'm talking about. They discredited the whole idea of activist government. And that plays powerfully in the background on all of this because there's nothing worse than failing spectacularly and in public, and they failed. And then, of course, they have failed to offer any counterarguments against sort of major budget cuts. You know, it baffles and enrages a lot of people. I don't mind saying it enrages me, too. I mean, this has become crazy. For Obama to sort of, in particular, the way he kept moving to sort of talk closer and closer, endorsing, you know, the Gang of Six.
Well, he had his deficit. He had his deficit commission before then.
Yes, he
which
had.
Was
Thank
paid
you.
For in, by Pete Peterson.
Well, in part.
Well, he paid for the salaries.
They paid some of the staff.
Right, exactly. But I'm still, let's face it, that guy's a deficit zealot. I mean,
it's hard to understand. And particularly, the thing that is most discouraging is the way they picked up Social Security, because Social Security's contribution to the deficit is essentially nothing. even their own apologists, like Peter Orszag, who was, you know, the former head of the Office of Management and Budget, who then fled to Citigroup there. I mean, he confessed in his little essay in the New York Times on that Social Security wasn't a major contributor to the deficit at all. It might add, he thought, 1% of debt to GDP at the end of 2050. And the issue where you get out to here is these long projections, which essentially show, he's basing it just like I am on the trustees' reports, although I think he probably wrote before the latest one came out, and I'm taking account of that latest. You know, that trust fund is in good shape through 2036, and if it fails at that point, they might have, if their growth projections were dead on target, which they won't be, they might then have a small shortfall. They'd still be making 70% or more of the revenue they need to pay out. So bankruptcy talk's crazy, but that's a very long time away. And there's just no reason to get that excited. I mean, listening to all these guys who could not see effectively the financial crisis coming in 2008 to sort of suddenly get nervous about a problem in 2036, this is really straining after gnats, or to use, what was it, Alan Campbell's thing where he was talking about he was going to spear all the whales. Social Security's a minnow. It just doesn't belong in any deficit discussion at all, no matter how many folks from the right tell you differently. You know, for Obama to embrace that nonsense is, I think, really disgraceful. And there is just no reason Social Security, you know, cuts in the form of cost of living increase formulas, they just shouldn't be on the table, particularly given the way ordinary Americans have had to pay the bill for the bank bailout and then watch their mortgages decline. It's really disgraceful. The Medicare story, we've been over this a fair amount too. They need to contain the growth of medical costs. There's no doubt about that, but we also know roughly what you got to do it, which is you need to do things like let the government use its bargaining power to bargain down the cost of pharmaceuticals.
Sure, and it's all happening in the private sector, by the way.
What's that?
I mean, the growth in medical costs are largely in the private sector.
Of course. Not with
Medicare. So that's another phony argument. Let me make a suggestion here. I know you had a piece in the Financial Times, Thomas Ferguson, about big money politics and how much the leaderships and the parties control the money. It looks like Bain is going to exact some punishment on some of these Tea Party people. We do this interview before we go to air. At this point, the vote has been delayed because Bain can't pull the votes together.
But I think he'll finally get them together.
Sure. Well, and by the time we go to air, he probably will have.
But it is my guess. Yeah, all right. Well, let's talk.
But what I want to do now is I want to play a clip of Senator McCain, just to give you an idea of how some people in the Republican Party view these Tea Party insurgents. Let's go to the clip.
The idea seems to be that if the House GOP refuses to raise the debt ceiling, a default crisis or gradual government shutdown will ensue, and the public will turn en masse against Barack Obama. Republican House that failed to raise the debt ceiling would somehow escape all the blame. Then Democrats would have no choice but to pass a balanced budget amendment and reform entitlements, and the Tea Party hobbits could return to Middle Earth having defeated Mordor. This is the kind of crack political thinking that turned Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell into GOP Senate nominees.
Now, that was a clip of John McCain quoting from a Wall Street Journal editorial to give you an idea of some of the feelings within the Republican Party from its traditional Republicans about how they feel about these Tea Party insurgents. Again, I'm joined by Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Do you think that there will be a reckoning here? Do you think the American people have seen that these people that swept in 2010, let me ask you this, in 2012, will the Democrats show up to vote to get rid of more of these people?
I think the Democrats showing up to vote is very much an open question. One of the things that destroyed the Democrats' chances in the Senate race in Massachusetts, which was the first fire alarm bell to ring in the night back when in January 2010, when Scott Brown upset the Democratic favorite there, was the stupendous fall off in Democratic towns there. You know, the fall off in voter turnout in 2010 from 2008 is the second largest in American history. That is to say, the decline in turnout. I mean, it normally falls off for an off-year elections, but that decline was huge. You know, I must say that I think the Obama administration is now seriously risking its own base. I mean, a lot of people are making jokes about, well, they're really, you know, liberal Republicans or something. It's not funny anymore. That's a real problem. But Ian, let me, if I could, come back to this question of the role of party finance in getting us to here, if I could.
Sure.
I mean, we're in this sort of insane position. You know, it's a piece I did in the Financial Times, was essentially picked up on this simple point, which is, since about the 1990s, both major parties have in effect started posting prices for committee chairs and leadership positions. That is to say, if you are a representative or a senator, you have to agree to contribute a certain amount of money to the party, and you have to raise more money. And typically you add in contributions of your own to your colleagues there. Now, the thing is that these contributions go into the national party committees. That's typically the national senatorial or the congressional campaign committees, House and Senate, respectively. Those are under the control of the leadership. So what you've done in the last 20 years is create this kind of legislative leviathan where you give the leadership vastly more resources. Now, if you're an entrenched incumbent, you can still afford to ignore them sometimes. But if you are running in an open seat election, meaning there's no incumbent, or you're under, you know, you got a serious challenger, which happens to everybody at least once, and then you really need those resources. And the national parties provide a lot of other stuff with that cash, notably consulting services, polling, and they also, I mean, for that matter, it's not legal to solicit. You can't dial for dollars out of your office, so you have to go somewhere near the Capitol and do it. And they go over there in the national party offices in those campaign committees often to do it. And that tends to put the leadership in a much stronger position relative to individual members of Congress than they were. Now, the Republicans do have an interesting fillip on this in that they've got some PACs that also want to push the party to the right. That is to say, they will actually run candidates against incumbent Republicans, which is very unusual. So you get a kind of double movement there where you have the leadership with much stronger authority over individuals, but everybody, including the leadership, getting pushed a bit to the right by some of these groups like the so-called Club for Growth and things like that. And this is really an important background to what's happening here, because you can see very plainly the way the party, this frantic effort on not a few people crossing party lines to do something in the national interest, but to move as a kind of like a giant crab. Everybody moves at once in this kind of lockstep. You know, it's a real change in legislative behavior, and what's driving it is money.
And it's driving America off the cliff.
Ian, you know, somebody said to me the other day, you know, I'm going to vote for Mickey Mouse. Disney's profitable. Everybody's happy in there. That's probably the best deal now. My joke for ages has been, look, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie. Don't watch politics. Then Tim Burton went to work for Disney, and I began to get nervous about that. But hey, yeah, it's a problem.
Just the notion that the economy of this country is being held hostage by people who like petulant teenagers, they want 100% of everything, and they're willing to take the whole house down. It's already affected markets. It's already affected confidence around the world. Here we are trying to sell T-bills every day. We have to sell billions of dollars of T-bills, and the United States government now is advertising to the world, don't buy our T-bills. I mean, this is an insane...
It's very odd behavior. It is, I think, extremely short-sighted.
Well, what rationality is left in the discourse? Do you really think that people are going to figure this one out, that these people really are irresponsible as well as being amazingly ignorant?
Look, I have to tell you, here you got to sort of be a little nervous, because a lot of folks, I think, you can see plainly, I think in the last three elections, many people just followed an in-out, out-in model. 2006, 8, 10, somebody said to me, gee, you know, in 2008 we threw out the Republicans, in 2010 we threw out the Democrats. Who do we throw out in 2012? when you look across history at this, especially in the Depression, which, you know, even though we're not at Depression, with the Great Recession is really a stupendous and calamitous event. What you find is after 3 or 4 years of this, the swamp creatures come out, and it begins to get really kind of rancid. And you can see, you know, there are all these groups suddenly forming with new, talking third parties and things like that, some of them very well financed. Now, I mean, there was one announced in Thomas Friedman's column last Sunday in the New York Times. They're a very well-financed group. The political system's breaking up because what's actually happening is the population detests both major parties and their political leaders. They don't like either of them. And that opens up the situation in a way that has not been open in our lifetime. So I'm not sure this is a happy ending. I think it will be a bumpy ride.
I thank you for joining us here today, Thomas Ferguson.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Ian. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.